Thank you, gentlemen, for reading. Our guest this evening, I met in the early days of my recovery. That was back when I was nervous, quiet, reserved, more so than I am now. Just trying to figure out the program. When he spoke in meetings, I perked up, my ears did. Because he usually shared something with insight and wisdom. So from that moment on, I started watching and observing and listening to him. Not only when he shared, but when he interacted with people. Shortly before I had 7 months, I was in a bit of a quagmire. It's a character on a cartoon show, but anyway. Conundrum, you know, situation. And so, to get some feedback, I approached Johnny. And he listened. And he gave me, well, he calmed me. And then he gave me a usable solution. Since that moment on, we've become real good friends. I liken our relationship to two theoretical physicists or a Zen master and a Zen student who are trying to discover and search the meanings of life and the universe. Then I have to remind myself that we're just two alcoholics with the same disease who are trying to live life the best we can, one day at a time. It's with great privilege and pleasure that I present to you Johnny B.
Take the pebble from my hand. My name's Johnny Blakely, and I'm what's left of an alcoholic. And if y'all don't think drugs and alcohol will hurt you, I'm only 26. It was no wonder I drank when I was a kid. My sobriety date, by the way, is May the 30th, 1997, so I'm coming up on 13 years, and if I don't get drunk, don't die, I'll make it. I hope. I ask God every morning to help me stay sober, and I thank him every night for helping me do so, and that's pretty much it. That's pretty much my prayer life. If he's as powerful as they say he is, he knows what I need already. Everything I need shows up in my life. My wants make me miserable. Sometimes when I get them, sometimes when I don't. I don't pray for anything except knowledge of his will and the power to carry it out. I understand that this is a 12-step recovery meeting and not specifically an AA meeting, so I may say some things tonight that I might not say at an AA meeting, but they're all about what has brought me around to the mindset to where no person in this room has the power to anger me anymore. I don't hate anybody anymore. I don't fear anything anymore or anybody anymore. People talk about natural fears. I really don't put a whole lot of store in natural fears. For me, natural fears are awarenesses. I'm aware of the fact if I step in front of a bus, I'm going to lose every time. That's an awareness. It's not really a fear. I could be afraid of being pushed in front of a bus. That might be painful. But I don't live like that anymore. I started drinking when I was 5 years old, and it's no wonder I drank. My parents stayed together the whole time I knew them, so I didn't come from a broken home like everybody else. I was an outsider. There was very little alcohol in the house. They'd drink a little beer every now and then, not a whole lot. No alcoholism, certainly. So I had to teach myself to drink. And I did a bang-up job of that. I have done probably a 5-gallon bucket full of cocaine in my life. Smoked a dump truck full of weed. And taken enough trips on LSD to get frequent flyer miles. And loved every one of them. Never had a problem with that. I remember it was in about 1995, I think, or 94. I was a crane operator, and I traveled all over the Southeast putting up and taking down tower cranes on condos, office buildings, things like that. And we were in Gulf Shores putting up two tower cranes on a new condo that was going up. And I got hooked up with this biker guy in the Floribama. Now, the Floribama for me was like Mecca. You know, I would bow and pray before I went in that place. Even somebody like me could get lucky in the Floribama. You know, I just knew God put that place there for me. Orange Beach, Alabama, my favorite place for years and years and years. And I still love it. Oil and all. Anyway, I got hooked up with that biker, and he said, do you do any acid? I said, I hadn't done any acid in 25 years. I was married to a woman who, for some strange reason, didn't like me doing drugs. I never could understand that quirk in her. I said, I hadn't done any acid in 25 years. And he said, you want to do a hit? I said, yeah, why not? So we were already pretty drunk anyway. So we walked out to his bike. He went in his saddlebag, pulled out a piece of paper, and tore off two squares of it, and he handed me one of them. And I put it under my tongue, and it was off to the races. And he said, I meant to tell you, you need to tear that paper in half. He said, I gave you two hits. And I said, well, they're gone now, bud. I said, I'll see you in about a week. And about 3:30 or 4 in the morning, I have no idea. I woke up out on the beach. I had passed out there on the beach, and there were some crabs trying to decide what to do with me. And I went back inside and still tripping my brains out, and asked the owner of the bar if there was a taxi available. He said, where are you going? And I told him. He said, my limo's outside. He said, grab you a beer and go sit in the limo. I'll run you home. So I did. And that was, and the next day I was beginning to come down and just getting really geeky, not really seeing things anymore, but enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun. A good way to phase out my drug relationship. And I was going to tell Sam a while ago that, you know, all these people in here look fine to me. You ought to cut them loose. They look great. Yeah. They look a hell of a lot better than I did when I got here, I promise you. That is one person that I have been glad to see every time I have ever seen the man. And I just love Sam. He has been such an important part of my program. At times, sometimes he didn't even realize he was being a part of my program, but he was. And thank you, Sam. I love you. I drank my way through high school. I was a little bitty guy. And, you know, I'm certainly not a giant now. I understand that. and really don't have a problem with it. I'm okay with it. I was never big enough, tall enough, rich enough, sexy enough, quick enough, smart enough, good looking enough, anything enough, until I got a couple of drinks of liquor in me. Then I was not only as good as you, I was probably a little better, and would not hesitate to tell you that I was a little better. Now, your opinion on the issue did not matter. Did not matter. I was a good time drunk. I was a party drunk. I mean, I've been in a lot of fights drunk, but most of them were really not that serious. It was, you know, one was scared and the other was glad of it, usually. But I was usually just a good time drunk. Liked to party and have a good time, show people a good time, and I was pretty good at telling jokes. And in the later years of my drinking, after I moved to Douglasville in 1990, I found out that if I could sit around a bar or sit around a table at a bar and keep a bunch of people amused, that they kept the liquor coming. So I had this repertoire of probably 50,000 jokes, and I would just start telling jokes as soon as I got to the bar. And I'd have people laughing and holding their sides, and they'd keep the booze coming. And it worked really well until, I'd say, the last couple of years of my drinking. And then all of a sudden, I really wasn't that funny anymore. My timing was off. I was telling filthy jokes. I was telling jokes that insulted people. I was telling jokes that told people that there was a lot of anger and a lot of rage in me that did not come to the surface until I'd had a good bit of alcohol. There's a man named Sandy Beach who is an AA circuit speaker, and I know most of you at some point have heard of Sandy. Sandy does a workshop, a Four Corners workshop in Tampa on something called ego separation. And when I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I understood that ego was pretty much just conceit. If I had a big ego, I thought a lot of myself, and I thought I was a lot better than you. I could not have been more wrong. About 2 years into the program, a friend of mine gave me a book called The Spirituality of Imperfection, and it's by a rabbi named Kuntz. Be careful how you pronounce that. It's K-U-N-Z, and and that's about as dirty as I'll get tonight, so don't panic. But he talked all through the book about how we are created to be imperfect. The only way we can be perfect is to be imperfect. Well, that all sounded really circular to me and really paradoxical. So I started, there was a lot of Eastern philosophy in his book that he mentioned, and he held a great store by Eastern philosophers. And I started studying Eastern philosophy. And I began to learn a lot of things about myself. I began to learn that I have a mind and I have a body, but I am not my mind and I am not my body. What am I? Well, I'm the awareness that is aware of the mind-body combination. That is the spiritual me. That's what I am. The body just gets me around the planet to do whatever it is I'm supposed to be doing here. According to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's to be of maximum service to God and those about me. I believe that. I try to do everything I can do to help people. I live by the Buddhist tenet that I'll do anything I can do to help you. If I can't help you, at least I won't hurt you. And that works pretty well for me. It works pretty well. I have found something in this program that I had never known before, and that was peace of mind. I went in the Navy, had a pretty uneventful trip through the Navy. I was a sonar technician and on a minesweeper, and it was like being in McHale's Navy, and we stayed drunk most of the time. Got out of the Navy, went home, played semi-pro football for 5 years. And on this team really, calling it semi-pro football is really giving it a lot of credit. It was more like an organized gang fight with equipment on. We kept a cooler of beer behind the bench. Inside that cooler of beer was a bag of pot. And right next to the bag of pot was a bag of speed. So just whatever you needed for the particular series of plays coming up was available. I loved it and enjoyed it, had a great time, and played for 5 years, and I met Ms. Wright and went to work for U.S. Steel, and I was afraid if I kept playing football, I'd get hurt, so I quit playing football, went in the horse business, and I was an electrician for U.S. Steel. I married a woman that I thought hung the moon. Before the marriage was over, she was throwing that moon at me. We had 6 really good years together, and 6 out of 18 ain't bad. If you can hit 300, you can play for the Braves, believe me. But there's nothing wrong with her. She is a good woman. She drank kind of like I did. We both drank and partied and had a good time. And we reached the point in our marriage where we were so ego-centered, so egocentristic, as the book says, that we began to bring out the worst in each other and not the best. We engaged in a lot of activities where neither one of us should have been there for any reason whatsoever. Her desire to leave me and my desire to see her go were not the result of any particular thing she did to me. I used to tell people for a joke in a meeting, I'd say, when I got divorced, I realized that my wife was about 90% responsible for our divorce. And I can look back now and see it was probably only about 85. Well, guess who the 85 goes to now? It's me. I was irresponsible. I always worked, always had to have money to drink with. I came from what I considered to be a competitive family. I always had to have a real nice house, real nice cars, real nice clothes, good-looking wife, the whole nine yards. Had to have the whole thing, or my life was not complete. I had no earthly idea what I was inside, who I was inside. When I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not know anything about me. I had become everything I said I would never become. I had done most of the things I said I would never do. I thought a lot of things that I said I would never think, that I would never entertain in my head. I didn't know where to go. It was the last house on the block. Got to where I couldn't look in the mirror. I was waking up behind the beer joint I drank in the weeds, in the rain sometimes, 3 o'clock in the morning. Have to get up and walk home in the rain. Because the cops in Douglasville really did not like for me to drive. After 4 DUIs, they thought I might have a problem. I knew they were crazy. But they thought I might have a problem. So I left the truck at home, and I didn't live that far from the beer joint, so I'd get up about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning in the woods, and I'd walk home, change clothes, go to work, and run a crane all day. Now, if you were one of the iron workers up on that steel that I was handing stuff to, you had no idea what was in the seat of that crank. It was somebody who was usually coming out of a blackout. I remember one morning I was hanging iron over off of Steve Reynolds Boulevard, and I carried a piece of iron up, I don't know, it was a couple hundred feet in the air, and there was a guy waiting on it about 150, 175 feet in the air. And on the way to it, one of the jobs that when you're hanging iron is you remember where you get each piece off the ground because that's where you're going to go back and get your next piece. Well, on the way up there, I realized I had no earthly idea where I'd picked that piece of iron up from. No idea where it was in the iron pile. Didn't know which end of it went where. Didn't know which end had the numbers on it because the numbers all run in sequence and they'll run it all in one direction. So I stopped and I left that piece of steel. Steel weighed probably 2,500 pounds, somewhere in there. So I stopped and I had it hanging in the air and I got out on the catwalk of the crane and I was just standing there trying to figure out what in the world is wrong with me. And a pusher came over there and he said, what's the matter? I said, I don't know. I just felt funny for a second. He said, you okay? You need to go home? I said, nah, I'll be all right in a minute. And then 5 or 10 minutes, I got back in the crane, headed, got a piece of iron, hung iron uneventfully the rest of the day. But that told me right then, this stuff had begun to affect my career. It had begun to affect my ability to work safely around other people. And I was in a position where I did not need to be out of control when I was working with these people. I could kill somebody completely innocent. So I was doing some graduate work at a DUI school. And a guy from the Douglasville group came to the DUI school and said about how he had found the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, how much his life had changed, the things that had been restored to him as a result of staying sober 2 years. And anybody in the room that felt like they might need to examine their relationship with alcohol, they would be glad to talk to you at the Douglasville group. Now, I went to the Douglasville group not long after this. I have never seen that person at a meeting. His name was John A. He was the PICPC rep for the Douglasville group. He was a real person. I just never saw him at a meeting. Why I saw him that one particular night and why what he said resonated with me, I don't know. But it did. And I went to that meeting, and I went up 22 stairs. The first night I went over there, I couldn't find it. He told me it was behind a drugstore in Douglasville. Well, I went behind every drugstore in Douglasville, and there was no AA meeting. Well, it was on top of the drugstore. The stairs were on the side of the building. So the second night, this little gray-haired lady's walking across the square in Douglasville, and I said, ma'am, excuse me, could you tell me where I might find an AA meeting in this town? She said, follow me. And I thought, this lady is an alcoholic? But anyway, it was MJ's wife, Freddie, and Sam knows her, knew him. And she carried me up those 22 steps, and I was walking towards this one light bulb that was hanging at the top of those steps. For some reason, that one light bulb hanging at the top of those steps was so prophetic to me. And it felt so good walking up those stairs because I felt like I was walking away from what was wrong with me. I felt like I was walking toward something that could help me. I felt like I was walking toward a solution. And that's all I'm about, is solution. I walked in the meeting, a bunch of people in there dressed reasonably well, laughing, talking, cutting up with each other. There's, I don't know, 8 or 10 people in there. And the more they talked, the more I identified. I didn't want to, but I did. I had felt the same things they had felt. I'd done the same things they had done, and worse. I thought maybe I'd pick a white chip up and give it a shot anyway. And I did. And about 80-something days into the program, I went to a meeting every day, at least a meeting every day, sometimes two meetings. Whenever I could, I went to two meetings. But I went to as many meetings as I could. About 80-something days, I was sitting at a red light, and I was on the way home from work. I was hanging iron somewhere over in North Atlanta. And all of a sudden, it dawned on me that I had not thought about drinking that day at all. And this feeling came over me like nothing I've ever felt in my life. This huge, enormous sense of calm just settled on me. And I realized at that moment, I never had to get drunk again because it had gotten to the point where I had to get drunk. That was the closest thing I guess I've had to a spiritual experience in this program. I've had a lot of God moments. A lot of God spots. A lot of things have been done for me in this program that would never have been done if there weren't a God, because it had to be something greater than me that did it. It wasn't me. This ego that I learned so much about studying Eastern philosophy, that's that part of my brain that wants me to think I'm separate and apart from every person in this room. There is a separate me, there's a separate Don, there's a separate Marcus, there's a separate Mark, there's a separate Mike, there's a separate every one of you. That's not true. in my opinion. I am a part of a greater whole. I am one tiny part of a magnificent Creator. I believe that there's a piece of my Creator that's put into me at the point of my conception. The rest of my journey through this planet, that piece of Him that resides in me is constantly trying to be reunited with its source. That's why I want to pray. That's why I want there to be a higher power. Because if it's just me, I'm screwed. I have no power over any person in this room, much less this county, much less this state. I tried running the universe one time and got laid off. I just didn't do a very good job. And that was before the recession. In ego separation, I separate myself from my source. And most of the quotes that I use in these talks come from the big book because they make so much sense to me. They just absolutely make so much sense. I separated myself from my source. I had no new power flowing in. I was running on my own batteries. They ran down. I got weak. Yeah, I was no match for y'all. I had no way to recharge the batteries until I reconnected. I learned from a Catholic priest named Anthony DeMello, or his writings, that that the best way to live my life is to make my life a prayer. Because in making my life a prayer, everything I do, I'm doing for something greater than me. I don't do anything just for me. I've learned that I can't be angry at another person. I mirror myself in every person I meet. The only thing I can condemn in you, with the possible exception of Mike, the only thing I can condemn in you is what I see in you that I don't like about me. In doing that, I have just condemned myself, not you. Judge not lest you be judged. That's how that works. I understand that now. Emmett Fox explained that. This forgiveness thing. I learned that all healing begins in forgiveness. And I've also learned that forgiveness actually is an illusion. The grievance I have against you is the grievance I have against me. I have never condemned you to begin with. I've only condemned me. If I forgive you, I'm actually forgiving myself. I never had anything against you to begin with. I just transferred my guilt feelings and my anger to you because it made me feel better to get it out of me and put it on you, and it made me feel a little bit superior to you to be able to do it. So all that's an illusion. None of it actually even exists. Everything I lived for when I drank actually doesn't even exist. So what did I have to give up to quit drinking? Nothing. I gave up some things that didn't even exist. I gave them up for a life that is peace, contentment, the opportunity to help other people. The fifth tradition, our primary purpose, is to carry the message, still suffering alcoholic. Maybe I should do that too. Maybe that should be my primary purpose. Maybe I should let people see God working in my life so they'll ask me why I'm so happy and I can tell them why I'm so happy. Because it's not me being happy that they see, it's God working through me. I can't outgive God. Anything I give to other people is replaced by more and better every time. Every time. I can't outgive God. But I can become a conduit that God works through where His love and His grace can go out to other people through me. That's what I try to do. I'm just an instrument. As the Zen master said, I'm just the finger pointing at the moon. And that's probably about as close to a Zen master as I'll ever get. My shoes are too tight. I go around to places. on a fairly regular basis, I guess, and tell my story and talk about what the program's done for me. And it's really not that different from what I've talked about tonight. I just don't talk about the cocaine, the LSD. But it's fun to talk about it every once in a while, and I appreciate y'all putting up with it. Thank you. Thanks for the memory. I began to read after I got sober, and I learned that that I could still retain things. And I had always wondered, when I was a kid, I had always wondered, what are we really? What are we made of? What are the basic building blocks of matter? And that's really kind of an odd thing for a kid to be thinking about, but I did. So I began to study particle physics. And I studied them in concept, not from the mathematical standpoint. I do not have that kind of intellect. I do not want to present myself as being some genius that likes to read that crap and enjoys it and stays up all night reading physics books. I don't do it. But I began to study what I could understand of these concepts. And from what they have found out in physics laboratories since 1900, they have discovered what the Chinese discovered 3,500 years ago. The Chinese said what we are primarily is a condensation of nothingness. The physics laboratories have discovered that what we are is primarily a condensation of nothingness. We are energy. We are light and love and energy. I can't explain my higher power. There's no way to explain my higher power. My higher power is love. That's why I can't explain love. I can tell you the effects of it. I can tell you loves that I've had, but I can't explain love. I have no earthly idea. I didn't even know why you gave a kid a teddy bear until, I'd say, 7 or 8 years ago. I give a kid a teddy bear so the kid can express his love or her love to the teddy bear, not so they can get love from it. They learn how to express love to something through squeezing and hugging and kissing these animals, these stuffed animals. Well, that just blew me out of the water. I had no idea that's why I love teddy bears and why I still sleep with one. Okay, she's inflatable. But it keeps me from smoking in bed. Anyway, I could go on, and y'all are just a terrific room to talk to, and I could go on for hours and hours and hours, and probably will. No, I won't. I've always heard that there's two marks to a good speaker. Be on time, know when to shut up. Everything else is details. Every preacher knows that a good sermon has two things, a good beginning and a good ending, and very little in between. So I'm going to wrap this thing up, and I am so grateful to God for everything I found in this program. I am grateful to God for every one of you, and I hope to meet you all. And as we travel the road of happy destiny, or trudge the road of happy destiny, I can't trudge, my shoes are too tight. Anyway, I thank Marcus for inviting me over here. Thank you. This has been a real treat. And it's good to see Don, good to see Sam, good to see Stan, good to see everybody. And I love all of you, and ain't a damn thing you can do about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Johnny. Appreciate that.